Yeah, if you can share in Paris. Okay, so today we get into the vegetable of the subject matter, which is Jiva Goswami's actual philosophy and what he's trying to do in the Sandarbhas. Yesterday I gave a little bit of an overview of the six Sandarbhas. To go into more detail would take a lot more time than we have. But I just want to remind you of the fact that the first three Sandarbhas were the most philosophical in their nature. Right? If you remember, the first three Sandarbhas, they're directed largely at an audience that may or may not have faith in Krishna already, or conviction that Krishna is the Supreme Personality of Godhead and everything related to him is spiritual, is transcendental. The Paramatma Sandarbha, the third one, is by far the most philosophical of all the Sandarbhas, of the first three. And it deals directly with issues in Indian philosophy, in Vedanta, which are of concern to philosophers much outside the range of Gaudiya Vaishnavism. So questions like, what is the nature of the world? Is it false or is it true? Is it real or unreal? What is the nature of us, the living entities? What is the nature of the Supreme? Is he personal, impersonal? Is he one, two, many, like that? What is the nature of the relationship between these three entities? Between us, between the world, and God. So basic questions like that. What is the nature of time and causality? How do causes produce effects? How does time function? Is time eternal? Is time temporary? Questions like these, which are asked over and over again in the history of Indian philosophy. And the Vaishnavas tend to give answers that are consistent with each other, and other groups give answers which are different. So there's consistency across the board, but still everyone has their unique twist on their answers and unique philosophies. So Jiva Goswami, in the first few Sandarbhas, he's dealing very directly, very consciously, with subjects that would be of interest to anyone who's educated in any field of Indian philosophy. They can pick up the Sandarbhas and say, okay, this is what the Gaudiya Vaishnavas believe, right? This is what their philosophy is, and get an immediate appreciation with it. And provide a point of argument, of reference, of dialogue, of polemic even, in which they can say, oh, this is your philosophy, I don't accept it, and here's why. And they'll give a counter-argument, and then you can defeat it like that. So this is the traditional way Vedantic debate takes place. It's back and forth. One person arguing one thing, and then they defeat it with a counter-argument. And as to why this wasn't done with this commentary on the Vedanta Sutra, which was Bhakti Vigyan Maharaj's question yesterday, we will talk about that tomorrow. That's the main subject matter. But today, like I said earlier, yesterday, the purpose of the Sandarbhas as a whole is to define the meaning, to delineate the meaning of all six, of the entire Srimad Bhagavatam. The word Sandarbha means a weaving, interweaving a tapestry, more generally just a treatise that's based on some other book. So Jiva Goswami is taking all the verses of the Srimad Bhagavatam and selecting those he considers very important and arranging them thematically so as to use them to prove Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's philosophy as grounded in Srimad Bhagavatam. This is the overall purpose of this analysis. So therefore, his most important task is to show that the Srimad Bhagavatam as a whole is consistent with or promotes Sri Chaitanya's philosophy. This is the most important task. If he can show that the Bhagavatam is basically our scripture, our text, it agrees with us, right? And he's already shown that the Bhagavatam is the best of scriptures, right? Then his task is complete. He's done what he needs to in speaking to those outside the tradition. He's established a traditional solid ground. So he's doing this throughout the Sandarbhas, it's rather the first three scenarios specifically. That's where he's mostly concerned with it. But at the end of the third scenario, the Paramatma scenario, he makes one final attempt at it as a sort of a cover-all last punch. And he does that by using a very old technique in Vedanta called Shadlinga or Shadpadalinga. Tatparyalinga, six. Tatparya means meaning, import, purport, and linga means indicators, signs. So, shat tatparyalinga, six indicators of meaning, six items you would look for in a text in order to define its meaning properly, in order to say this is what it means. So, this is a technique that's been used in Vedanta, in fact even before Vedanta, for thousands of years practically, to establish the meaning of any text. If you come to a book and you say, what's the main point of this book? Like, what's the book trying to prove? Then you say, okay, I look for six things in this book. And if I can show that all six things are harmonious, they agree, then whatever they agree on, that's the point of the book. This is a very important technique, because the whole purpose of Vedantic philosophy is to show that all the Vedic literatures, right, they're so vast, so many different philosophies, so many different ideas in the Upanishads and the Brahmanas, Aranyakas, Vedas, the Puranas, Itihasas, so many branches of learning saying different things. But the goal of each one of the great acharyas is to show that all of these literatures are two things. One, they're consistent, means they all agree on the same point. And to show their philosophy is consistent with all these literatures, and it covers them comprehensively or completely. So consistency and completeness, right? These are the two most important values that are present in Vedanta. Every philosopher has to show these two things. If you have a philosophy and it agrees with half of the Vedic literature and doesn't agree with half, then it won't work. You'll be defeated very quickly. And if it's not consistent in its own right, it doesn't hold together properly, then also it'll fail. So these two things are very important. And to decide what the main meaning of the text is, it becomes crucial, because you want to say, okay, what's the main point of the Bhagavatam? What's the main point of the Bhagavad Gita? What's the main point of the Vedanta Sutra? If you can show that and say, my philosophy shows is agreeing with this main point, right, then you've basically covered the text. It's sort of a shortcut method to deal with the whole thing, instead of having to go with every single verse. So at the end of the Paramatma Sanava, Jiva Goswami is trying this. He's saying, I'll take a shortcut method and I'll see if I can cover the entire Srimad Bhagavatam and determine its meaning using these six indicators of meaning. Shankaracharya used this technique with the Upanishads. Through using this technique in the Chandogya Upanishad, he basically showed that the main point of the Upanishads is the famous Mahavakya. Anyone know? The famous statement? The Tattvamasi. That art thou. You are that. Meaning you are the Supreme. You are Brahman. Okay. So he's saying, this is the main point of all the Upanishads, specifically Chandogya Upanishad. And he does that not by going through every single verse and every single text. He has commentaries also, but there's a quicker method, and that's using the six indicator method of determining the meaning of the text. Even before Shankaracharya, it was used by the Mimamsakas, by the ritualists. All the acharyas are using it over time. So today we'll look at how Jiva Goswami uses this and how we can very quickly understand the full meaning of Srimad Bhagavatam through this technique. Now, what do you think? Wait, by the way, again, like I said yesterday, if you have any questions along the way, need clarification, like to make a comment, please feel free, because with this sort of subject matter, if you try to hold it till the end, then it's bound to get out of context and forget your question. So just keep asking. The Japanese gentleman.
Well, what's the criteria of choosing, like, we use this painted material? It seems to be like a selected in order to see the meaning of the essence of the short article. But what's the criteria of choosing this text? Because obviously, one might think that, well, it's a list, just arbitrary selection.
Very good question. We're just getting to that. This is the next part of the lecture. Okay, just before that, what do you think is the main point of Srimad Bhagavatam? What do you think Jiva Goswami would want to show as the main purpose of Srimad Bhagavatam?
Krishna is to Bhagavan's time.
Okay, that's good. That is the ultimate point, of course. But remember, we're saying he's writing here for an audience that's not yet convinced fully of Krishna, and he's sort of trying to speak in as general terms as possible. So your answer has the answer within it, but it's just not so specific.
That God is a person?
That God is a person, exactly. What's the word we use it commonly in Sanskrit?
Bhagavatam.
Right. So that the ultimate point of the Bhagavatam is Bhagavan. Okay? Bhagavan is the ultimate goal of the Srimad Bhagavatam. Now, this at first sight, this looks like a little bit like a, of course, the Bhagavatam, right? The Bhagavatam, that word itself means the book which deals with Bhagavan. That's why it's called Bhagavan. Just like one who worships Vishnu or is in relation to Vishnu is called a Vaishnava. Right? One who's in relation to Kunti is called Kaunteya. One who's in relation to Bhagavan is called Bhagavata. So either the devotee is called Bhagavata or the book is called Bhagavata. So you can say, well, that's very, very clearly obvious. You know, what's there to prove in that? It's right there in the title of the book. And it's about Bhagavan. But it's not as obvious as that, because Jiva Goswami is not as foolish as that. And he's got a much better point to make, a much stronger point. And that's because what he means by Bhagavan is something very specific, very in the word Bhagavan, he means it's Bhagavan. Basically, the word Bhagavan is a technical term by which he means something very specific in our philosophy. Bhagavan, that word, encompasses within it the entire range of Gaudiya Vaishnava philosophy. Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu philosophy is there in the word Bhagavan.
Did you want to say that the highest truth is personal?
Yes. So what is, this is exactly the point, what is included in the word Bhagavan? So this fact is, Bhagavan means one who is a person. See, these things are not given, because the word Bhagavan itself in Sanskrit just means one who's fortunate, one who's blessed. So many people are called Bhagavan, just like in the chapter this morning from Srimad Bhagavatam, just a few verses before the verse we're dealing with, Kardamuni is called Bhagavan. Brahma is called Bhagavan, Shiva is called Bhagavan. So many people are called Bhagavan as just a respectful title. It doesn't have to mean anything more than respected sir. Just your teacher you can call Bhagavan. So what he's trying to show is something much more. Note that the point of the Bhagavatam is Bhagavan in this sense of the term. Bhagavan, and this is what I mean by Bhagavan. So what does he mean by Bhagavan? So one thing is he's a person. God is ultimately a person. What else? Yes, he possesses all opulences. Yes, all the energies. Right? So the six Aishwaryas, right? All strength, beauty, knowledge, and the energies, the Shaktis. That's in fact the most important characteristic of Bhagavan, is that he's energetic, he has Shaktis. That's what differentiates him from Paramatma and from Brahma, the other concepts. What else?
Maybe Jamalasya is the source of everything.
Okay, he's the source of everything.
Controller.
He's the controller. What about, is he alone? On his own?
been not answering the question.
Of course, when you say he has shaktis, that already includes plenty of other things with him. But just to delineate further, you know, Jiva Goswami, his associates, his abode, his paraphernalia, all these things.
So I'll read you a definition of Bhagavan from the Bhagavad Sandarbha.
This is the longest sentence I've encountered in the Sandarbhas so far. A long, long definition. But it's every single phrase of it is very important. Okay, so listen carefully here. Okay, who's Bhagavan? He who is the very form of existence, consciousness and bliss, so Sat Chit Ananda, who possesses inconceivable, multifarious and unlimited energies, shaktis, that are of his own nature. Right? So they're not something that he gets from somewhere else. They're not something that you acquire, like we learn how to drive a car or we learn how to play the piano. Not like that. It's something that's intrinsic within him. He who is the ocean of unlimited, mutually contradictory qualities. Thank you. Such that in him, both the attribute and the possessor of attributes, the lack of differences and the varieties of difference, formlessness and form, pervasiveness and centrality, all are true. So, the definitions or descriptions of the Lord's energies is that it's aghatana ghatana pratiyasi, that which makes the impossible possible. Durghata ghatatvam makes that which is difficult very easy. And Krishna is called viruddha dharma ashraya, he who's the shelter, the abode of all contradictory qualities. So there's so much duality in the world, so many contradictions, and we know everything comes from God, from Krishna. So which means that in him there's hundreds of contradictory things. He's formless and he has a form. Right? He's the largest, like we read in Ishapanishad. He's the fastest and he's in one place. He's largest and he's smallest. All these things live together very happily in Bhagavan. And this is one of his key characteristics. There's no problem in contradiction. And everything stops at him. Everything rests at him. Whose beautiful form is distinct from both gross and subtle entities, self-luminous and consisting entirely of his own nature. So there's no difference between his body and his soul, like there is for us. Who has unlimited such forms that are manifested by his chief form called Bhagavan. So Bhagavan is the source of many incarnations, avatars. Whose left side is beautified by
Radha.
Or here he says Lakshmi. Again, this is due to the fact that he's writing for a general audience. Right? So they have less appreciation for Radha than we do have for Lakshmi. Who is the manifestation of his personal energy suitable to his own form. So when Krishna appears, then she comes as Rukmini. When Rama appears, she comes as Sita. When Nrisingadeva comes, then she comes as Lakshmi. So in every form, she's taking a form that's suitable to his. The manifestation of his personal energy is suitable to his own form. Bhagavan resides in his own abode along with his associates, who are furnished with a form that is a special manifestation of his own splendor, who astonishes the hosts of Atmaramas, those who take pleasure in the self, by his wonderful qualities, pastimes, etc., which are characterized by the play of his personal energy. So his lila, his pastimes. So Bhagavan is active, he's not passive, he's not just an observer, he's doing things. Whose own generic brilliance is manifested in the form of the reality of Brahman. So Brahman is his, the rays emanating from his body. Who is the sole shelter and life of his marginal energy, called the jivas. Whose mere reflected energy are the gunas visible in the unlimited phenomenal world. That person is Bhagavan. So this is like, it's a definition of Bhagavan, and it's almost like a summary of the entire Bhagavad Sandarbha. You can take each one of these sentences and it's basically like a chapter in Bhagavad Sandarbha, proving each one of these points. At the end, he brings it all together in one long sentence. He says, this is the thesis, this is the point. So this is what he's trying to show, is that Bhagavatam, this is the main point of Srimad Bhagavatam. that this is the idea. So what he's showing is not something trivial, in other words. It's not that Bhagavan from the word Bhagavan. No. He's showing something. And if he can show this, then like you saw, all of our philosophies encompass in that definition. Right? Everything we understand, the idea of Shaktis, of threefold, everything is there. So if he can show that Bhagavan is the main subject matter of the Bhagavatam, then he's shown everything. He's shown our whole philosophy. So this is what he set out to do in the in determining the meaning of the Bhagavatam.
Now, to Keo's question.
What's the criteria for determining which things you choose? Okay, so there's, first of all, there's six categories. Now, I hope everyone can at least look over someone's shoulder for this, because we need to have a kind of control. Okay. So, first way, you tell the meaning of a text. If you want to know what's the main point of a book, okay. So, what's a very common thing when you do, when you pick up a book and you want to, before you decide on buying it, what do you look at? What's common?
Index.
Table of contents and
cover.
Cover. And
backside.
Backside. The index. Someone said index.
Maybe forward also.
Forward.
Price.
Price. Good.
Forward.
Some that you had.
Okay. Let's say
price. Yeah. Okay. Okay. So the first way of determining the meaning is to look at the opening verse and the concluding verse of whatever you have. And they should match in their meaning. And if they match, then whatever they agree upon, that's the main point. So the author generally said makes his thesis in the first few pages, and then concludes again with a repetition of what the main point was in the last few pages. So those are very important. Secondly, what is repeated in the text over and over again? So if the author is making a point again and again and again, then you have a pretty good idea, but this isn't something important for the author. Right? This is one of the main points. This is called abhyasa. The first one is upakrama, upasanghara, then abhyasa. So the first, the opening and the conclusion, that makes one. You have to make sure they agree. The number two is repetition. What's repeated? Then the third one is interesting. What's new? The novelty in the text, apurvata. This is, if you read textbooks, say you have in any subject, an engineering textbook or a philosophy textbook, there's so many textbooks that have already been written. And any time a new textbook comes out, you'll see, you'll read in the foreword and the preface and the introduction, it says, well, there's hundreds of other textbooks written, you know, on this subject, but none of them have cartoons which make it easy for this reader to understand. And therefore the purpose of my book is to present engineering through cartoons. And this is why I'm writing this book, or philosophy through cartoons. There's actually a series like that, philosophy through cartoons, through caricatures. So that, like that, what's the main point? Prabhupada does the same thing in the beginning of Bhagavad Gita. Right? He says there's 700 editions of Bhagavad Gita. So what's the point of another one? What is the point of another one? Well, none of them present the philosophy as it is. Everyone is trying to propound their own agenda based on the words of Krishna. And so what I'm here is presenting as it is. And therefore my contribution is unique. Therefore you should read the book. Therefore you should pay the price. So novelty, apurvata, what's new about it, gives you a good idea of why the author wrote it. Number four on the next page is the phala, or the fruit. What are you going to get out of it at the end? In any course, you have aims and objectives. The students at the end of it, they should be able to do such things like that. This is the purpose. This is what you're going to get out of it. Within 2 years, you'll get a bachelor's degree on the internet. Therefore, you should pursue this course. The fruit. That's the fruit. Number five is a little more. It is not so immediately straightforward. Arthavada. This is commendatory statements, statements of praise. When the author in the book has statements that are not necessarily making a point, but are simply praising something. Like you can tell the author is especially appreciating a particular fact that has a lot of good things to say about something. Then you say, okay, he or she has a particular affinity towards this topic. So not necessarily making a point or arguing something, but simply, you know, waxing eloquent about a particular subject because you can tell the author's gone into it, really enjoys it. It's called arthavada. Subordinate statements that are of commendatory nature, praise. And the final one is perhaps the most difficult to, in most cases, to understand. And that's the actual reasoning of the argument. What's what's in between the introduction and the conclusion? What's the author's main argument? How does he reach his conclusions, basically? This is called upapatti, or the reasoning. So these six things you put together, and if all of them agree on one point, then you can be very certain that that's the main point of the book. So if what the author is repeating over and over again is the same as what he says in the introduction, is the same as what he says in the conclusion, it's the same as what he's trying to prove by argument, is the same as what he's praising and waxing eloquent about, is the same as the result as which he hopes to get from it, if all of these things agree, then you can be very sure that that's the main point. So this is Jiva Goswami's strategy here, saying, let's look at the Srimad Bhagavatam, find these six things and see if they all agree. And he wants to show that they all agree that Bhagavan is the main point of the Bhagavatam, that Bhagavan is supreme. Bhagavan in the sense that we just described it. Because he just spent the last 9 hours talking about who Bhagavan is. So before we go on, why don't we read through these six verses together? Verse and translation. The first two verses can be sung in the same tune as the Shaiv Goswami Ashtaka.
Janmadyasya yatolvaya ditaratas Jatesha vidya swara Ene brahma nilaya ditavaye
Okay, the translation together. O my Lord
of Sri Krishna, Son of Vasudev, O all-pervading personality of Godhead, I offer my respectful obeisances unto you. I meditate upon the Lord of Sri Krishna, because he is the absolute truth, and the primeval cause of all causes of the creation, substance, and destruction of the manifested universes. He is directly and indirectly conscious of all manifestations, and he is independent because there is no other cause beyond him. It is he only who first has heart of the great knowledge of the Lord of Ramaji, there is no beginning. By him, even the great sages and demigods are placed into illusion, as one is bewildered by the illusory representations of a water seeing fire or land seeing of water. Only because of him do the material universes, temporarily manifested by the reactions of the three modes of nature, appear factual, although they are irregular. I therefore meditate upon him, Lord Sri Krishna, who is eternally existent in the transcendental world, which is forever free from the illusory representations of the material world. I meditate upon him, for he is the absolute truth.
I should have the Kumari Priya recite this on her own, because this verse is on the examination for all the college students for their Sanskrit pronunciation course. It's a very difficult Sanskrit verse on its own. It's got all difficult combinations of sound, and practically the whole Sanskrit alphabet is there. So all the students are required to memorize the verse and recite it from them during the examination. And, last year and the year before, all of them did it successfully. So this is the opening verse, Upakrama. Now the concluding verse, Upasanha. Same tune, same melody.
Kasmayena vibhasito yamatulo yanam radhipapura tarumena chanarada yamunaye krishnaya tatrukina yogindraya tatatmana tabhagava rataya karunyata
I meditate upon that
pure and spotless Supreme Absolute Truth, who is free from suffering and death, and who is the beginning personally revealed these incomparable sources of the knowledge of Brahma. Brahma has spoken to his sage Narada, who narrated it to Krishna by Vyasa.
Okay, before we go on, can anyone, the opening statement and the concluding statement are supposed to match, right? So can anyone spot immediately what is matching between these two verses? Satyam param dhimahi. Let us meditate on the absolute truth. Now, to go to Kiyo's question now, how does Jiva Goswami select these as the verses that are going to fill the categories? We'll see in the others also, they're sort of selected from different places in the Bhagavatam. And you can say, well, I can select anything from the Bhagavatam and show that it is, you know, that they prove something. That's true. The opening verse, of course, is very clear. It's 1:1:1, the first verse. But the second, the concluding verse, is actually not the very last verse of Srimad Bhagavatam. It's about five verses before the end. However, Jiva Goswami chooses that as the concluding verse because of the fact that it has this phrase, Satyam Param Dhimahi, in it. Now, you can say, well, this is sort of circular reasoning. You're trying to show that the opening and the conclusion match. And how do you choose your opening and conclusion verses? Well, because they match, right? And that's the basis upon which you choose them. So this is, you're not proving anything, you're going in circles, right? Yes, however, the point of choosing these six verses, or these seven verses actually, total, is that it doesn't actually matter where you choose them from, or which verses you choose. So long as you can show that they all agree on it, they match. So the concluding statement has to be somewhere near the conclusion, naturally. The opening statement has to be somewhere near the beginning. But it doesn't have to be the very first verse or the last verse. You can select. The fact that these two verses agree is in itself the evidence that they're the right choice. Because the main sort of value that the main point of this selection, like I was saying earlier, is that they have to match, they have to be consistent. So if you can show consistency in selecting your verses and show that all the verses are consistently pointing to one thing, then that in itself justifies your selection. Okay? This is an important point. Consistency is the primary value, and completeness, these two things.
But what if somebody uses it for another subject?
Yeah, that can be possible. And for that, you would basically say, okay, give me something else. You know, I say the primary import of the Bhagavatam is Lord Shiva. Right? He's the main point. Right? So if you can show these six verses, then yes, then we can have a debate about it. We can argue about it. But chances are it's going to be kind of difficult, because you'll see to get all six things matching, I don't think Lord Shiva is mentioned anywhere in the opening verses or even in the concluding verses. But Lord Vishnu is mentioned by name over and over again. Bhagavan is mentioned.
Brahma
is mentioned. The Adi Kavi, the original poet. Unfortunately, he's one of the people getting inspired by the transmission of Bhagavatam, so it doesn't quite work. He's not the Satyam Param.
It's also
not,
mentioned in the conclusion verse.
Yeah, but there too, he's the recipient of the knowledge, not the source. Right? This concluding verse is interesting because it's giving basically a guru parampara. He's saying in the beginning, the Lord instructed this lamp of knowledge to who? Yeah, what's his name here? What's the name given for him? No, in the second verse. Ka. One of the names of Brahma is Ka. Is he? The letter Ka represents Brahma. Which letter represents Vishnu? We know from the Bhagavad Gita. Krishna says, Aksharana Makarasmi. Of letters and the letter A. Lord Brahma is Ka. And I think Shiva is E or something like that. I'm not sure. So he says, in the beginning it was instructed to him. And this knowledge was passed down through the parampara. But I worship that supreme truth, Satyam Param. The first verse is very, very important. And we'll spend most of tomorrow, or maybe the day after, depending on how much we get through, on the first verse. Jiva Goswami uses the first verse to comment upon the beginning five sutras of the Vedanta Sutra. All the first few sutras are found in this first verse of Srimad Bhagavatam. Their meanings are all present here. So he spends a whole lot of time discussing this verse. It's very, very important verse. Okay, now this... next verse, the meter is kind of difficult, so maybe we can do a repetition thing rather than together. We can repeat after. Kalimala Sanghati Kala no Kileshu.
Kalimala Sanghati Kala no Kileshu.
Harilita Ratra Nagiya Tehya Bhikshnam.
Harilita Ratra Nagiya Tehya Bhikshnam.
Ihatu punar Bhagavan Shesha Murtihi.
Ihatu punar Bhagavan Shesha Murtihi.
Paripathito Nupadam Katha Prasangai.
Paripathito Nupadam Katha Prasangai.
Okay, translation together. Lord Hari, the supreme controller of all beings, annihilates the accumulated sins of the Kali Age, yet other literatures do not constantly glorify Him. But that Supreme Prasad and Bhagavad, appearing in his innumerable persons and actions, is abundantly and constantly described throughout the various narrations of the Srimad Bhagavatam. This verse shows two things, repetition and novelty. So what's the repetition that's present in Bhagavatam? What's being repeated? Who's being repeated over and over again? What's being
repeated?
He's being glorified. The absolute truth. In Anupadam, in every word, in every phrase of Srimad Bhagavatam. And what's unique about the Srimad Bhagavatam? What's new? This very fact, right? The fact that Lord Vishnu is being glorified over and over again, that in itself is unique about the Bhagavatam. So the two things, he can use one verse for both of them. What's repeated? Bhagavan. What's unique? Well, the fact that he's repeated in every verse, that's unique. Because Jiva Goswami makes the point that so many scriptures do talk about Vishnu, but none of these scriptures talk about him as repeatedly and as exclusively as Srimad Bhagavatam does. Bhagavatam talks about Bhagavan in every word, in every syllable. And that's all the Bhagavatam talks about. So the others talk about Bhagavan once in a while, sometimes. They'll talk about other people, they talk about rituals, they talk about what you're supposed to do when, you know, someone dies in your family and do these ceremonies and this and that. And then once in a while they talk about ritual. The Bhagavatam, no. Everything, this we know from the second verse, right? Dharma prajita kaita bhakti. Everything else is rejected, and only Bhagavan is repeated over and over again. Now you can say, well, other things are described in the Bhagavatam too. There's descriptions of genealogies. Such and such was the son of such and such, was the son of such and such. It goes like that on and on. You think, well, how is Bhagavan being described there? But there again, Jiva Goswami makes the point that the Bhagavatam only describes this other stuff that seems to be peripheral, only in relation to Bhagavan. only if it leads to a narrative about Bhagavan, or if it glorifies Bhagavan in some way. So you hear the story of Swayambhuva Manu and all his descendants. Why? Because in his family, you get so many great devotees who are the reason for so many appearances of the Lord. You have Uttanapad is one of his descendants, who is the father of Dhruva, because of whom Lord Vishnu appeared. Devahuti is one of his daughters, because of whom Kapila Dev appeared. So the story is related to Bhagavan in every way. So only those things. They won't give you genealogies of people who conquered India, and it was stuff like that is not there. Other Puranas do give histories, mundane histories, but Bhagavan will not. This is what's unique about Shiva.
In this method of Satatparya Linga, does the point which is repeated in the scripture have to be the same point which is there as a novelty, or can these?
It just so happens that it is the same in the case of Srimad Bhagavatam, but it can be different. So what's new doesn't have to be. I mean, you don't have to have a matching verse for both of them.
Yeah.
The fact that it's repeating something doesn't have to be its uniqueness. Okay, the fruit. Again, we can repeat it. Vivantiye bhagavata atmana satam.
Vivantiye bhagavata atmana satam.
Katham vitam shavana puteshu sambhritam.
Katham vitam shavana puteshu sambhritam.
Punantite vishaya vidushitashayam.
Punantite vishaya vidushitashayam.
Prajanti tacharana saroruhantikam.
Prajanti tacharana saroruhantikam.
Translation together.
Those who train into oral deception, fully filled with the nectar in the message of Lord Krishna, the beloved of the devotees, purified and polluted the aim of life and known as the pure enjoyment, and thus go back to God, the lowest seat of Him, the personality of God.
Now, it's very common in Sanskrit texts that at the end of a work you'll have what's called a palashruti, or the statement of the result of reading that work, what you get from it. We find this very often in Srimad Bhagavatam also at the end of stories. Like one who hears this narration of Prahlad and Narasingha will achieve, you know, pure devotion at the Lord's lotus feet. Or one who hears this description will be victorious over his enemies. So we hear these descriptions very often at the end of work, even at the end of songs, of prayers. One who recites these eight verses every day in the month of Kartik will achieve devotion to Lord Dhamma. So that's sort of the standard. And Bhagavatam has that also. In fact, it has many, many verses in the 12th canto would say, by reading Srimad Bhagavatam, this is the result you get. However, this verse is not anywhere near the end of the Srimad Bhagavatam. It's not anywhere near the Palashruti. Rather, it's from the second canto of Srimad Bhagavatam. Why? Why is it coming from the second? Why is Jiva Goswami choosing a verse earlier? The answer lies in the context of this verse, where this verse is being spoken. Does anyone by any chance know what the context is of this verse? When it's being spoken? For what purpose? It's very early on in Srimad Bhagavatam. It's a conversation between Shukadeva and Parikshit. Right? And we know at the beginning, Maharaj Parikshit asks Shukadeva Goswami many questions. And the most important of those questions is, or the most pressing for him, is what is the duty of a man about to die? So his most urgent question. Now, the whole Bhagavatam is an answer, basically, to his questions, and to this question in particular. But before he goes into many other narrations, Shukadeva Goswami answers all his questions in a succinct manner, very quickly, in the beginning. In the first two cantos, he gives a basic answer. By the end of the second chapter of the second canto, he's given his basic answer to this question. What is the duty, to most of his questions actually, but specifically this one, what is the duty of a man about to die? He's made this answer already. This is the last verse of that chapter. right after this, the next verse in the third chapter, he says, "Now I have answered your question." But Parikshit Maharaj has more questions, so then the Bhagavatam goes on. But at that point, you can say the Bhagavatam is complete. It's actually finished. He says, "I've answered your questions. This is it."
At which point exactly?
At this point, this verse, chapter 2 of the second canto, verse 37. He, right after this, in the beginning of 30, he says, "I've answered your questions now. I've told you what is the duty of a man about to die." So, in a sense, this is the end of the Srimad Bhagavatam, the first rendition. Srimad Bhagavatam itself is spoken like 5 or 6 times in the first 2 cantos. It's spoken by Shukadeva Goswami to Parikshit Maharaj. Who else speaks Bhagavatam? The entire Bhagavatam is conveyed.
Shukadeva Goswami, we just say this at night, sir.
Okay.
Brahma to Narada.
Brahma to Narada. I'm not sure if it's complete there, because their conversation goes further. But there's others that are complete there.
The Chaturus one.
Yeah, complete in 4 verses. So like that, there's 5 or 6. The whole Bhagavatam is narrated 5 or 6 times just in the first 2 cantos, and this is the first. This is the first time the Bhagavatam is actually complete in the first 2 chapters of the second canto. Now, this is actually a much better place to take the Phalashruti from, the statement of fruit, because at the end you have sort of a general statement that is kind of disconnected from what you've just been reading. This is the book, and this is what you get from reading it. But here, the fruit is very much connected to the storyline. The fruit is visible in the life of the person we're talking about. That here's, we've just read about this great king who's been cursed in 7 days to die because of a mistake he committed, who decides to give up the world, go to the bank of the river Ganges, listen there. Shukadeva Goswami arrives, and he's desperately looking for answers for hearing about the glories of the Lord. He asks Shukadeva Goswami, he answers his questions and says, "I've answered you completely." Right? So we get the whole context of the story, and for the listener it becomes much more intense at this point, actually, because you have something that's relevant. You have someone's life here, just like a couple days ago Mother Urmila was talking about the power of stories, right? The power of narrative. So this is, here you've got the description of the fruit, of the result, in the context of a narrative. Right? So it's very, very powerful. You can see, yes, there is this result, because this person here, who is about to die in 7 days, and who is desperately wanting to know what to do, right, he achieved the desired result. He achieved what he wanted. And he's being assured in this condition by Shukadeva Goswami. So it's a very... very good choice of verse. Jiva Goswami is very careful in the verses he selects. Okay, let's do the last two quickly. This one we can sing together. It's like the Shat Goswami Ashtaka again.
Yam Ramava Varunendra Rudra Maruta Sunvanti Dilyai Savaya Vedai Sangha Pada Kramo Panishada Gayanti Yam Samaga Jnana Vasita Tadgatena Manasa Pashyanti Yam Yogino Yasyantam Navidu Sura Sura Gana Devaya Tasmai Nama.
Sutta Goswami says, "As a lad of personality, Brahma, Varuna, Indra, Rudra, and all the traits, chanting the transcendental names, the satisfied villages of all their followers, Bhagavatam and Upanishads, to whom the chanters of the Sanskrit are always singing, whom the perfected yogis see within their minds after fixing themselves in trance and absorbing themselves in the name, and whose living can never be found by any demigod or demon, unto that supreme personality of the world, I offer my humble praises."
This is a statement of praise. It's very obvious why everyone is praising Krishna in every way. The Upanishads, the Devas, the Devas. Jiva Goswami says very little on this verse. It's basically two-line commentary on it. So I'm not going to say anything more.
But what does it mean by subordinate statement of praise?
Subordinate because it's not sort of the main point the author is making, but he's just praising sort of the subject matter. So it's not his main argument or his main thrust. The statement of praise is itself subordinate to the main thrust of the book. Sort of,
how this idea of subordinate statement is expressed in Sanskrit, Arthavada?
Arthavada. The word Arthavada has a very long history in Mimamsa, in Karma Mimamsa, in the ritual tradition. And there, the real reason why it's considered subordinate comes out. Because basically the Mimamsakas, they say, there's a whole history behind this, but basically the Mimamsakas, they say that only the activities enjoined in the Vedas are important. Mm-hmm. This is what Krishna's preaching to at Govardhan, in Govardhan Lila, right? He's preaching to his father, Karma Mimamsa philosophy, that it's actually just the activities that's important. The demigods and all the controllers are all under the control of the activities themselves. So what they say is all the injunctions in the Vedas, so if the Vedas say offer sacrifices like this, put ghee into the fire, those are the important statements. And any other statements are subordinate. So they have a completely different idea of how to approach the Vedas. So if I say Krishna's tu Bhagavan Swayam, they would say, does that tell you to do anything? No. Therefore that's a subordinate statement. This is their approach. If you say, if offer fire oblations to Krishna, that's the primary statement. The Vedantists come along and they reverse it. And they say, we basically look at the other way around. We say, no, the knowledge gained is the main thing. So Krishna's tu Bhagavan Swayam, that's the main point. Okay? And the injunctions that are listed along with it, they're the subordinate statements. Or the statements of praise that are present, like this one. So this is a big source of disagreement between the Mimamsakas and the Vedanta. It's a whole sort of...
But the Sanskrit Arthavada means subordinate statement.
No. Arthavada just means statement of meaning.
Yes.
Right? But the way it's used in history is always as a subordinate statement. Everyone uses it that way. Statement of meaning, or artha means value also. So that's why you can get statement of praise, statement of value. Okay, last one, reasoning. And this is always the most difficult of all the six in terms of meaning.
Bhagavan sarva bhuteshu rakshita svatmana hari drishya bhutyadi drashya lakshamayanuma pakam.
The personality of God, the Lord Sri Krishna, is an every living being along with the individual soul.
And this fact is perceived from the hypothesis that our acts of seeing and taking on top from the intelligence.
This could take an entire class simply to explain what the reasoning is that's happening here. Jiva Goswami has a very, very long section on this. And he's using methods of proof from Nyaya, from Indian logic, their systems, to show that basically no matter where we start in our reasoning about the world and about ourselves, we will have to end up at Bhagavan as the supreme goal, as the supreme purpose. You can do this through the method of contradiction, or you can do this through the method of reasoning. But any method you choose, and anywhere you start, your path will end. If your reasoning is correct, it'll take you to Bhagavan. It'll take you to the Supreme Lord. Very involved, detailed discussion. It's actually very nice if someone's inclined to get into it. It's a very satisfying discussion. Maybe I can hint about it in future classes. Any final questions before we stop? What time is it?
Can you once again say it's not yet very clear to me why this praise in text number 5 is a subordinate statement? I can understand that this is from the perspective of karma, of karma mimamsa.
subordinate not in the sense of lesser in importance, or not in the sense of putting something down. It's not a diminutive sense here. Subordinate in the sense that Bhagavan is not, he's not being directly discussed or proved here. What's happening is we're saying someone else is praising Bhagavan, right? So it's you're talking about someone else glorifying Bhagavan. It's like a little bit indirect approach. Just like in the Gita also, Arjuna says, right, it says, Param Brahma Param Dhamma Pavitram Paramamma Asito Devalo Vyasa Svayam Chayam. All these rishis are praising you. So he's describing, he's not saying, Krishna, you are, he's saying you are this, but here in this verse he's saying, instead of saying Bhagavan is like this, they're saying all of these people praise you in this way. So it's very important, very nice, and this verse of course is very famous, very beautifully sung by devotees. But it's from the perspective of reasoning, of establishing the meaning of a text, it's talking indirectly about what others say about Bhagavan. You see what I mean?
I'm very interested to understand the principles here in this Satyatarya Linga. So any Satyatarya Linga, when the fifth point is brought, the Matavada, I have to bring out that others are talking about the subject matter. Is that the logic?
Yes, someone is praising.
Someone is praising.
That's the idea. For us, the element of praise is more important than the element of subordination. Mm-hmm. For Mimamsakas, the subordinate idea is more important. But for us, praise is the main point. Someone has to be praised.
When I was teaching Krishna Upanishad, I was trying to use this particular method for analyzing the content of Krishna Upanishad. And I had difficulties. My question here is it necessarily that any classical text or any text will have all the points? Because sometimes you have a hard time to find the points, so you feel
it's too small.
Artificial. I don't know, to kind of put the things together. So is it like this is the science of hermeneutics. To use this method, there has to be also rules for composition. In other words, if somebody wants to prove this some points throughout the test, he has to use all the points. What if some of the elements are present in the text?
I don't know exactly what happens in that case, because each of the instances I've seen this method using is with quite large works. Like the Chandogya Upanishad is a substantial size. This is what Shankaracharya uses. With the Isha Upanishad, I was thinking of that myself, whether something could be used for that, you know. Because, for example, Prabhupada has a very clear point that he's making with the Isha Upanishad. It's proving that God is a person, right? So here's something that's excellent for that this purpose. You say, can I take the Isha Upanishad and by these six methods show that God is a person? But it's so few verses that, you know, there's not...
Well, they also use the same method for deciphering this text from I don't remember which Upanishad, about two birds sitting in one.
Yes.
Just for one.
Yes.
In Vedanta Sutra, they take just one verse and they give the same method.
Yes. It can. Yeah. Exactly. Right. even with one verse. So I mean, I've never seen it done with Isha Upanishad. I don't know if it has. So if you can do it with Isha Upanishad, that would be
a
new contribution to
it. It definitely works with the matter of instruction. The matter of instruction is very easy.
This is what we do tomorrow. Okay, it's going to be a little bit fun tomorrow. We start off the class. Everyone should bring one scripture with them. Okay, so Bhagavad Gita, or Isha Upanishad, or Nectar Instruction. Something. Don't bring something too easy. You know, like Nectar Devotion. The main point is devotion. That's you can use this method and you can prove it. Right, but that's not argued by anyone. No one's going to argue with you and say, no, the main point of Nectar Devotion is jnana. So it's sort of like, it's not so exciting to prove it. Try to choose a text that others can read also, maybe it's outside of our tradition, and say, no, I think the main point of Bhagavad Gita is do your duty. right? Or the main point of Bhagavad Gita is be a good hardworking man. So many people say that in India. Do your duty, be a good hardworking person. This is it. This is what Krishna is telling Arjuna. We say no, it's surrender to Krishna. That's the ultimate point. Can we actually prove that using this method? Is it possible? Prabhupada says over and over again, bhakti is the main point. Bhakti is the main point. Can we show that using this method? Or if we try this method, does jnana turn out to be the main point of Bhagavad Gita? So bring some book, and you know, if all of you want to bring Bhagavad Gita, that's fine. But bring some text. We'll divide up into groups of 3, 4, 5, or whatever is comfortable. And then, just quickly, it won't take too long. We'll see if we can come up with these six things from that text, and see what comes up. Again, I said, like I said, it's not going to be the same for everyone, because these verses are chosen in some sense arbitrarily. You can choose anything you like, but you have to be able to show that all six of your choices match, and they prove what you want to prove. So you don't have to choose the first verse as the first thing. You don't have to choose the last verse of the Gita as your concluding. You can choose other things also. What repetition you choose, that'll change amongst people. So we'll divide into groups, and then we can just compare what set of six verses or seven verses we come out with from the Bhagavad Gita. It would be a nice exercise. And we might come up with surprising results. What the main point of the Gita is.
You want to do that beforehand, or just bring the book?
Just bring it. You can do it beforehand if you like, but then you'll be kind of bored in the first 20 minutes at the class. Okay, but please do bring a book with you.